Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. This is the eighth episode in a 20-part series of podcasts on the history of the Catholic Church. In this episode, we're looking at the 7th century, the years 600 to 700 AD. In each one of these episodes, I've tried to pick out a particular challenge that the Church faced in each century, a particular tragedy, but also a particular triumph which answered that. It might have been a corruption in the church. It might have been heresy, persecution from without. And in each episode, we've seen how the church has learned its lessons and moved on through the guidance of the Holy Spirit. Well, in this century, the 7th century, we see the continued rise of the power of the Pope. This is both power over the Rome, over the church, but also power over the infrastructure in Rome and the temporal power of the Pope. And this comes into contrast and conflict with the power of the emperor in Constantinople. So this is a major theme of this century, and we'll see how this unfolds in the lives of various individuals and in the lives of the whole church. And this is a conflict which is not just about politics. It's going to be about church governance and about theology as well, and we'll see how that happens. But to do that, we have to first set the stage a little bit. And to do that, we need to go back and step back into the 6th century and even earlier to be reminded of what has been going on. Remember, the Great Roman Empire is crumbling. It's fraying around the edges, and the barbarians are invading from almost every different quarter. In 410, the year 410, Alaric the Goth sacks Rome for the first time. And then continuing through the 400s, the invasions continue with the Goths, the Vandals, the Huns from the east. And Rome and the Roman Empire continues to shrink and to struggle. During that time, of course, the capital has been moved east to Constantinople, and the emperors are based there. Then in the 6th century, in the 500s, there's a bit of a pushback. The emperor Justinian reclaims a good bit of the territory that was conquered by the Goths, and there's a resurgence of the empire. And this was not necessarily good news for the citizens of Rome, because they, in one way, exchanged their Goth overlords for the tyranny or the oppression of the emperor in Constantinople, Justinian. And there's a good description of Rome itself during this time period, during the 500s. And during this time period, the various structures of society had broken down. The noblemen, the ruling classes, had moved out to the countryside and were not taking responsibility. And a kind of a symbol of this is what happened to the aqueducts. You'll be familiar with the famous aqueducts that brought fresh water from the mountains down to Rome for the baths and for the fountains and the water supply. The various invading armies had broken the aqueducts on purpose in order to deprive the Romans of their water supply, but also they had stripped the linings of the aqueducts of the lead and therefore the aqueducts were leaking and turning the low-lying lands all around Rome into a fetid swamp. So there was disease, there was a stench, people were moving out of the city, out into the countryside, the population was shrinking. We saw how in the 500s, Pope Leo the Great stepped up to the plate and began to take responsibility for the administration of Rome and feeding the poor and keeping things together. Well, during those 500s, during the 6th century, the invasions continued. Justinian's gains against the Goths were then pushed back by the invasion by the Lombards. The Lombards were a Germanic tribe, really from southern Scandinavia, a coalition of tribes, really, who moved south, and eventually they crossed the Alps in 568. About 10 years later, they actually besieged Rome, and it was during the reign of the Lombards, who eventually took over most of Italy, that we see some important changes happening, which lead us into this week's century, the 7th century, from the 600s to the 700s. Right at the end of the 500s, at the cusp of this turning point, a very, very important figure is elected as Pope, and that is Pope St. Gregory the Great. Gregory came from a noble family, and it's important to put him in context with the century before, because the important figure of the century before was St. Benedict of Norcia, who founded the monastic orders, which would then become the foundation for medieval Europe. Now, Gregory was actually a Benedictine monk. He went on to write the biography of Saint Benedict, and he, as a young man, sold a lot of his property and established a Benedictine monastery in Rome. And you can still visit the site of that monastery at the Church of Saint Gregory in Rome. You can see the marble seat, which they claim is Gregory's chair that he used when he was Pope, and see this the reconstructed room where they think was his monastic cell. Gregory loved his time as a Benedictine monk, and he didn't want to come out and take power. He didn't want to take a leadership role. He enjoyed the studious, quiet, contemplative life of being a Benedictine monk. One of the gifts that he gave to the church was to formalize the chant, which was already used within the monasteries, and it's come down to us now as Gregorian chant, which comes from the Benedictine tradition and as a gift to the church of this great Pope, Saint Gregory the Great. Well, what else did Gregory do? Gregory got involved when he was elected Pope in 590 with, a bit like Leo, taking charge of a crumbling society. He helped to fortify the cities and against the Lombards. He helped to gather food and clothing and shelter for the poor. He began to help with the infrastructure of Rome and putting things back on their feet. But he also began to assert power in the church. A lot of the dioceses, the bishops, and the monasteries and the abbeys were really a law unto themselves. They were doing their own thing, and Gregory sort of drew them together and tried to achieve church unity and tried to achieve a church infrastructure as well as one for this civil society of Rome. Gregory, therefore, used his monastic friends to help make this happen. He appointed monks to the high places in the church, and this was one of the things which helped to push the church towards mandatory celibacy for priests, because monks more and more were the ones who were running the show. Monks were the ones who were making things happen in the church. The monks were not only helping Gregory with the administration of the church and the temporal holdings of the church, but he saw them as missionaries. And so he sent the missionary monks out to establish monasteries, pushing the influence of the church north and west into Europe. And one of the main missionary enterprises that Gregory is famous for is the mission to England. And the old story goes that he saw some Anglo-Saxon slaves in the marketplace in Rome, and he saw their beautiful fair skin and blonde hair and said, "Who are these people?" And someone said, they're Angles, my lord. And he said, "Not Angles, but angels." And he commissioned Augustine of Canterbury, to go and convert the British. So Augustine went to England, and he arrived there in 597. So about 7 years into Gregory's pontificate, he sends Augustine and a troop of monks off to England. And they land in Kent, and the king of Kent was already married to a Christian queen. And so he converted, and his whole nation converted with him. So we have to take a little bit of a detour from Pope St. Gregory here and focus on this mission to Britain, because you will remember from the last episode that the monastic missionaries had come surprisingly from Ireland in the previous centuries, and they had established monasteries in the west of Britain, western Scotland, and in northeast England, and pushed all the way into Germany and Belgium as well. And so these missionary monks from the Celtic Church were already there in Britain, and it's as if they were cut off from the rest of the church. So Gregory sends his Benedictine monks to be missionaries to Britain, and when they get there, they find that there are Christians already. The great monasteries at Monk Wearmouth and Whitby and Iona and in Ireland, and these monasteries were great centers already of Christianity and learning and missionary effort, which were in Britain. So, but there was a clash that developed. And that is over the date of Easter and on various monastic disciplines and practices. When Augustine gets to Kent in southeast England, he has to deal with a not a totally friendly welcome from the monks who were already there, the Celtic monks. And so there was a contrast, a conflict between these two groups of Christians. And finally, it came to a head at the Synod of Whitby in 664, in the middle of the 7th century. And at Whitby, the Celtic monks and the Roman monks came together and debated the proper date for the date of Easter. And the king was King Oswiu, and he listened to both sides, and he finally heard the monks from Rome, and he heard their appeal to Peter, as to the Pope as the successor of Peter. And he said, if these monks are speaking with the voice of Peter, then I must agree with them. And so the two churches were reconciled at the Synod of Whitby in 668. And this was a result of Gregory's mission of the Benedictine monks to England with St. Augustine. So under Gregory, the church is expanding to the north and to the west into Europe. And as they go, it's the Benedictine monks who are establishing the outposts and establishing the infrastructure for the church to expand further north and west into Europe. Just a reminder of the six pillars of the Benedictine life, the three vows of obedience, stability, and conversion of life, and what I call the three tools of reading, prayer, and work. These practical aspects of the monastic life were intrinsic to the Benedictine way, and they're also intrinsic to the establishment of firm and solid communities. I could spend all day talking about these six and how important they are, but you can see when you think it through that with reading, prayer, and work, you're establishing an intellectual foundation, a foundation of hard work and enterprise, and also a spiritual foundation with prayer. And with obedience, stability, and conversion of life, you're establishing a monastic order which is structured, which is interdependent, and which is ordered so that it can actually be a firm foundation for a Christian society and for a Christian community. So Gregory, we have to thank for all these great gifts to the church, and also for establishing a foundation for the papal power, which would be an example to future popes. One of Gregory's favorite titles was for the Pope was the servant of the servants of God. And Gregory's wise, compassionate, self-sacrificial, smart leadership set the tone for popes to come. And not all of them would live up to it, unfortunately, but he set the tone also for the Pope's relationship with the temporal powers. Well, that brings us to the end of his papacy at the beginning of the 600s. What follows now in the rest of this 7th century is one long soap opera of a struggle between the popes and the imperial powers over in Constantinople. And the historian Eamon Duffy calls this the Byzantine captivity of Rome, or the Byzantine captivity of the papacy, because the emperors are asserting power over the church and asserting power over theological questions in a way which is conflicting with the power of the Pope and the authority of the Pope. And the emperor has got several problems because he's based in the east in Constantinople, but there are pressures on the empire, which has already been seriously reduced by the dominion of the Lombards, who have really dominated all of the Italian peninsula during this time. But also the pagans are pushing in from the north, and the Persians are pushing in from the east with their religious philosophy of Zoroastrianism. And it is during the 7th century that another very important figure arises, one which is going to be very disagreeable to the Christian church, and that is the Prophet Muhammad. In the 620s, Muhammad appears on the scene and establishes his religion to the south of the empire in the Arabian Peninsula. And he dies in 632, but his conquering armies continue in his name their conquest of the Middle East. So by 637, the Muslim armies had taken Antioch in Syria. By 642, they'd moved on to North Africa and taken Alexandria in Egypt. And then in 698, right at the end of the century, they continued their conquest by taking Carthage. So the Christians are feeling very beleaguered. The Lombards are occupying the Italian peninsula. The Muslims are taking over the Middle East and North Africa. The Persians are pressing in from the east, and the pagans from the north. And the emperor, in fighting these battles, increasingly is seen as a holy warrior, as a kind of prince and priest at the same time. And in fighting off these battles, he is seen as being a conqueror in the name of the cross. And this, therefore, gives him immense power and gives him an immense sense of authority in the religious sphere as well. And this is going to be in conflict with the powers of Rome. And the way it comes to a head is in a continued debate about the nature of the incarnation in our Lord Jesus Christ. You can remember this has been going on now since the beginning of the 4th century, with the Council of Nicaea in 325, and then Chalcedon, which then corrected some of the heresies which had grown up. But still these heresies persisted, especially in the East, and various emperors would take the side of the heretics and support them, and that they would therefore cause division in the church. And the heresy which continued to persist in the East was the heresy of monotheism. And this is the heresy which teaches that Jesus Christ does not have two natures, but one nature. The Orthodox belief is that Jesus has two natures, human and divine, united in one person. And monotheism says that it is only one nature. And this was causing conflict back and forth between Rome, who was held out for the Nicene and Chalcedonian belief, and the emperor in Constantinople, who is increasingly supporting monophysitism. So the theologians come up with what they believe is a solution to this problem. Are there two natures in Christ, or one nature? And they say there are two natures, but they are united in one energy or in one will. And I'm having trouble getting my tongue around all these different heresies, but you know, this one is called monothelitism. And monothelitism is the idea that there is one will that unites the two natures. And initially, everybody thought this was a great idea, and indeed, even the Pope at the time, Pope Honorius, in the 630s, believes that this is a good solution to the theological problem, and he sends two documents off to the emperor and to the theologians in the East, endorsing this solution of monothelitism. But monothelitism turns out not to be such a good idea after all, because if there's only one will in Jesus, then his human will is denigrated, his human will is lessened, and if he doesn't have a fully engaged human will, then he's less than human. And we're right back to the same problem before that we had, where Jesus is more God than he is, more divine than he is human, and his humanity is denigrated. And so the Roman theologians and the popes actually say this isn't going to do, this monothelitism, and we're going to hold out against it. The emperor is not happy about this. Well, Pope Honorius, who actually, we have to say, in those two documents, compromised the truth of the papacy, he was succeeded by Pope Severinus, who is then succeeded by Pope Theodore. We're now in the 640s of this 7th century. And these two popes reject the imperial control over the theology and hold out against monothelitism. Now, you can see what's happening here. Is this a theological debate, or is this a debate about power? Is this a face-off between the popes who don't want to give in to the emperor, or the emperor who doesn't want to give power to the popes? Is it really about theology? Well, it's probably about both. And so Pope Theodore is then succeeded by Pope Martin in 649. And Pope Martin is even more of a hardliner against monothelitism, and he follows up Pope Theodore's idea, and he holds a synod in the Lateran. The synod in the Lateran gets together all the theologians of the West, and they condemn monothelitism formally. Well, this infuriates the emperor, and the emperor decides that he's had enough. So he sends his exarch, who's his authority in Italy, from Ravenna, whose name is Olympius, and he sends Olympius to Rome in order to suppress all of these discussions about monothelitism and to suppress the objections of the Roman clergy and the Pope. And he says if he can't do that, he needs to assassinate Pope Martin. Well, as it happens, Olympius changes sides, and he foments rebellion against Emperor Constans, and the rebellion fails. So, not to be daunted, Emperor Constans then in 653 sends another representative to arrest Pope Martin. By this time, Pope Martin has taken refuge in the Lateran Basilica. He's actually set up his bed in front of the high altar, and he's hiding there from the emperor's soldiers. But the representative comes in anyway and arrests him. And Pope Martin is kept in terrible conditions there in the Lateran Basilica. The detail is that he suffered from dysentery, and they didn't even allow him to wash for over a month. So he's kept in house arrest in terrible conditions by the authorities of the emperor. And he still doesn't give in on this question of monothelitism, so they take him to Constantinople as a prisoner. He's paraded through the streets and humiliated. He's jeered at by a furious crowd, and then the emperor puts him on trial, not only for heresy, but puts him on trial for treason, because he assumed that Pope Martin had also sided with the rebel Olympius against him. And so Pope Martin is found guilty. He's stripped of his vestments in public. He's paraded through the streets in shackles. And finally, he's exiled to the Crimea, where he dies in 655. Well, what a terrible time for the papacy. And to make matters worse, the Romans, after their pope had been arrested and exiled, elected another pope, which was pleasing to the emperor. And the emperor comes over to Rome, and he tries to make nice with everybody. But while they're fêting him and feasting with him, he sends his soldiers out to sack Rome once more and take off more of their treasures back to Constantinople. And the historian who recorded all of it was obviously Eamon Duffy. Says he was could not disguise his delight when the Emperor Constans was murdered in his bath in the year 688. Well, the next emperor is Constantine IV, and he actually reverses a lot of the strict regulations, and he tones down the conflict, and he actually accepts that monothelitism is a heresy, and he goes along and agrees with the Western theology and the Western understanding of our Lord's incarnation. So all seems to be peaceful and going in the right direction. However, Constantine IV is then succeeded by Justinian II. And Justinian II doesn't like the power of Rome, which continues to increase in Italy, and he doesn't like the power in the church, so he brings in a decree trying to impose Eastern ways on the Western church. And that takes us to the end of this particular century, the 7th century, from 600 to 700. This great soap opera continues into the next century, and the next episode, episode 9 of Triumphs and Tragedies, will deal with what happens next. But you can see that the eventual split between the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church was a long time in coming. It's something which had been brewing for a very long time, and this conflict is all tied up with the politics and the military exploits, as well as the theology of the church during these important centuries. So what can we actually take away and learn from the 7th century about the church today? Well, we've seen that the church is in a time of transition and change. It's chaos and it's crisis, and things are moving quickly, and there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of division and strife. And God raises up from within that both an astounding pope to lead and set the standard and point the way, Pope St. Gregory the Great. But he also, and this is what happens all the way through church history, he also raises up saints. who in their own quiet way, in their own little corner, are doing God's work and setting the spiritual tone and the intellectual tone for the church. And of course, these in this particular age, these are the Benedictine monks coming out from Italy, moving north and west into Europe, but also not forgetting the Celtic monks who were coming east from Ireland and establishing monasteries. And these two great missionary efforts are what really renew the church during this particular age. And notice that these are not political efforts. These are not high-profile efforts. These are just monks who are establishing monasteries and communities and doing what they can with what they have where they are. In the last episode, I mentioned the book, The Benedict Option by Rod Dreher. Rod Dreher looks at the Benedict answer, and he looks at the times that we live in now, and basically draws the conclusion that a lot of us have drawn, that we also live in times which are tumultuous, times which are confusing, times which are confusing in the church and in the society, times which are confusing for our families in all sorts of ways. And Rod points out, and I agree with him, that the answer to this is the answer that we also found in the 7th century, in the 6th and 7th centuries, and that is to establish communities based in conversion of life, stability, obedience to the faith, working hard, praying hard, studying hard. And these schools, these parishes, these families, these dioceses will be the beacons of a faith for a new generation. They'll be the foundation for faith for a new generation. And so we can learn from the triumphs and the tragedies in the 7th century of the church, from Pope St. Gregory the Great, from St. Benedict, and from the Celtic monks, how to cope with the difficulties in the age that we find ourselves. Thank you for listening to Triumphs and Tragedies. I'd like to remind you about my blog, Standing on My Head. Just go to dwightlongenecker.com and you can read my blog posts every day, listen to my podcast homilies. Also, you can be in touch, you can browse my books, and in the church history section, I write a special blog post for each of these episodes, giving extra links, pointing to extra books, and continuing the discussion about the various events from the particular centuries that we're covering in this broadcast series, Triumphs and Tragedies. Thank you for listening.